Natural Living with Gary Null, exploring the nature and politics of medicine, health, nutrition, and the environment. And now your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I am Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to the program. For those of you who are just coming on board, this is an in-depth investigative report on AIDS, a second opinion. I just noted that on some of the previous programs, I had given the numbers that were numbers 10, 11, and 12, and 13. I am incorrect in that. The programs that I'm doing, including the one that I'm doing at this moment, is program number 16. The previous one would have been program number 15, the one before that 14, the one before that 13. So again, today's program is number 16. My previous program numbers for the last four shows I'd been off. I was actually looking at my vaccine series and hence gave the wrong information. In studying the program that I am taking on, the challenge of trying to share in-depth information for us, I'm trying to show that we have not been given a true and accurate picture of what causes AIDS, let alone its origins, and that virtually everything, absolutely everything, from where it originated in Africa to how to test for it with an HIV antibody test, to the drugs that we should be using, to how it got started in the United States, all of this should be open for reevaluation. And without the ability to reappraise these hypotheses, we will continue to go in the wrong direction and not be able to supply the American population and those people suffering from AIDS conditions. You see, the conditions, the 30 different opportunistic or infectious diseases or immune-repressed diseases we call AIDS, those are real. But to suggest that a weak retrovirus that some claim has never been fully identified, the HIV virus, and others claim has been fully identified but is not adequate to do this damage, then we continue in a misguided way, in effect another medical Vietnam. So in this program today, I will continue with my discussion of what's wrong with our hypothesis, what we must reevaluate, what the journalists have failed to do, their homework, what the scientists have failed to do, drop their dogmas, what the doctors have failed to do, examine cause and effect. So it's as if we have an entire group of people who are simply on the wrong track. What can we do about it? Join me now for an in-depth investigative report. Picking up from where I started on my last program, hopefully people have had a chance to continue with the series, but I will give you enough information that if you have not heard previous programs, this will still be adequate in giving you some understanding. And again, please note that this is program number 16 that we're on right now. If we suppose, for the sake of argument, that a new virus does exist, though it might be asked, why would it originate in the West? Can we just reverse the arguments, seeing that sexual promiscuity is a more pronounced characteristic in Western nations than in Africa? No, that would be a jump from one stereotype, oversexed Africans, to its mirror image, oversexed Americans and Europeans. There's really no answer to this yet. Although, since we have listened to a great deal of what Chermutis has to say about the falsicity of making Africa's AIDS birthplace, a subject to which he has devoted great thought and study, it might be worthwhile to hear his ideas on this subject. As he sees it, the AIDS virus may have been produced accidentally in a scientific laboratory. Bear in mind, he is mainly citing the potential for an errant biotechnology to cause diseases such as AIDS, not identifying this technology as the culprit, he argues. One possibility that has been given scant attention in the vast scientific literature about HIV and AIDS is an artificial origin of a mutant virus. This would seem rather surprising, as the risks of mutant viruses emerging from laboratories has been widely debated for many years. To back up his account of a general concern over the issue, He notes that in the early 1970s, several molecular biologists published a book, Biohazards and Biological Research, while in February 1975, an international conference on molecular biology was held in California where they agreed on a policy of self-regulation. In 1976, the National Institutes of Health released guidelines for research on recombination of DNA molecules. And in 1977, the Federal Interagency Committee on Recombinant DNA Research issued an interim report suggesting laws that might be enacted to regulate this field, laws that were put into law the following year. Not only should scientists have been aware of this research as a possible production site for new viruses, but as Chermuda notes, they should have been aware that monkeys, which might have had SIVs, were often experimental subjects. Hundreds of thousands of African green tree monkeys and other species have been exported from Africa to research laboratories in Europe and America, where they've been subjected to experimental infections and their tissues used in cell culture. He asked which one would prefer to if faced with these two hypotheses about the origin of the disease. One, that of a lab worker in a Western country being bitten by a monkey who had been given an artificially altered virus, or two, that of a monkey with a mysteriously naturally altered virus infecting an African in the bush. Each hypothesis is equally unlikely. Chermuda says, but the choice of which to believe is systematic of the prejudice of Western scientists. That the latter hypothesis, not the former, has been pursued suggests that factors other than science have been guiding the activities of AIDS researchers. The thoughts closing this subsection are merely suppositions about how scientific endeavors may have erred and played a part in unleashing a virus. However, we no longer need to depend upon suppositions in the text section where we will document some of the bad science that has been used to create the magnified projections of HIV infection and the labeling of any cause of mortality under the sun as an AIDS death. Let's look at bad science of AIDS lambasted by African doctors. As promised, as we examine for the first time or revisit some of the problems with accounting for the amount of actual existence of AIDS and HIV in Africa, we'll focus particularly on the opinions of African physicians and health workers and social workers. For them, we will learn especially about the questionable statistics and the tendency of establishment doctors to carelessly attribute many deaths to AIDS without thorough examination of the cases. We will also note the idea often raised on the continent that AIDS in Africa is not a new disease, but a new label placed upon old conditions that have been around for centuries, although recently exacerbated. Let's begin with a telling anecdote. There is no doubt that the media's drumbeat has often created panic and fear in Africa, just as it has over here. Dr. Gelsler reports, in Uganda, people in some areas, like the Reiki area, are aware of who is bringing illness to them and flee from those physicians who approach allegedly for just doing HIV tests. In Kampala, the weekly Topic newspaper accused CIA agents disguised as scientists and journalists of spreading lies about the origin of the virus. Shortly afterwards, unknown persons ransacked the house of Winston Carswell, the leading AIDS research scientist in Uganda and a member of the British Armed Forces, and destroyed his computer together with all the AIDS files he had. Is this evidence of more African irrationality? Pace Schultz, or could it be that the spreading of lies, although not done by CIA agents, has been the outrageous proposition, enough to sometimes justifiably enrage Africans? For one thing, as we've already seen when we noted the thoughts of Kenyan columnist Philip Oshing on how HIV infection statistics were extrapolated to the whole population using prostitutes as the sole and exclusive and only people sampled, the method of deriving statistics of overall infectivity leaves much to be desired. All that needs to be added now is that Oshing is not the only African who scoffs at the oversized estimates of a forthcoming or already present AIDS epidemic, a story in New African recounts. A growing number of African physicians, and the list includes Dr. Martin Matti, Midland Center for Neurology in England, Dr. Sam Akawar, former director of AIDS research in Uganda, Dr. Pak Addy, director of clinical microbiology in Kumasi, Ghana, say they think the panic over the heterosexual transmission of AIDS may be a hoax. When Dr. Felix Alua, a Ghanaian physician at London's Cromwell Hospital, went to several African countries after hearing that AIDS was devastating these nations, he gave his report in the prestigious journal The Lancet, where he stated that he found no evidence of an out-of-control epidemic. He wrote, "If tens of thousands are dying from AIDS and Africans do not cremate their dead, where are their graves?" Neville Hutchinson, who was sent by the Times of London as its senior science editor to Africa, concentrated on talking to African doctors and officials about the extent of the crisis. He says, "I couldn't find any evidence of an AIDS epidemic in Africa. I visited Kenya, I visited Zimbabwe, I visited Zambia, I visited Tanzania. Okay. I visited these countries, but I talked to people at high levels within those times I was there. I found that when you question people more closely, when you find that many of them had grave concerns about the picture the world was being given, they felt because of the scare of the large numbers of people testing positive that an AIDS epidemic was forthcoming. But they didn't actually have an AIDS epidemic upon them in most instances. The health minister in Zimbabwe told me that the biggest health threat to his country was an epidemic of what he called HIV-itis. He said it was like a fear created by the HIV story, which was jeopardizing people's health in a major way. To Hutchinson's mind, this HIV-itis does not only strike people who become deathly afraid of getting ill, but health workers who, in anticipation of an epidemic, are all too ready to either find results of HIV infection that are not there, or boost them to help secure funding for the increase of disease that is just around the corner. He says, AIDS workers genuinely believe HIV presented a huge threat which would destroy millions of lives tomorrow. Because they believe there is an epidemic, they think they're doing the right thing in multiplying HIV and AIDS statistics out of proportion to the facts. Thus, they pushed huge increases in deaths in the near future based upon small and completely skewed statistical basis. Part of the reason for the overstimulation of what terror the disease would unleash on the continent, an overestimation registered, for example, in the already noted differences in infectivity and the death in the African and West statistics, is with Africa being higher in infectivity but much lower in deaths from AIDS than America, is that the ELISA tests tend to cross-react with typical African infections. The African population in Ecuador, Africa, is subject to malaria. Although I previously took on a look at the tests in a previous program, there's one nuance that has not yet been noted, and which suggests that we revisit the topic briefly. This additional nicety is that African doctors usually do not and have not been acquainted with the problematic nature of the test, which has often caused them to hide their doubts about results. Before noting some of their trend reactions, as they become more aware of the limited value of these tests, let's remind ourselves of some of the shortfalls of the test. For one, the ELISA cross-react with both leprosy, bacteria, and TB germs. A report in the Journal of Infectious Disease states, quote, "The test detects the presence of antibodies to antigens associated with infections of Mycobacterium leprea, which is leprosy," unquote. Since this leprosy bacteria shares a number of outer shell markers with tuberculosis, the presence of TB in the blood will also cause a cross-reaction. People with active TB infection are therefore liable to be at greatly increased risk of testing false positive because of the tuberculosis, not because of HIV, unquote. As we've mentioned, there is a high incidence of tuberculosis in Africa. According to a scientific article on this, of the 660 million people in sub-Saharan Africa, an estimated 3 million have active TB with an annual death rate of almost 800,000. Now, we can see the mistaken identification of TB as HIV infection will jack up the numbers of those who are considered to have been killed by AIDS, particularly in that 50% of African AIDS deaths involve tuberculosis. So right off the bat, in lay language, what this means is that we should subtract approximately, and this is an approximately 50% of all cases that are claimed to have died of AIDS in Africa should be subtracted from the statistics. In a previous discussion, we went through a whole gamut of other diseases that can fool the HIV antibody test and render false positives. As is clear then, the more infectious agents that a person has been exposed to, the greater the likelihood that such cross-reacting antibodies will be present. It should also be easy to recognize that multiple infection is the norm in Africa. In fact, we can draw on an orthodoxy to confirm this. An article in Immunology Today, whose authors take at face value the reliability of the HIV antibody test, nonetheless lays stress on this factor. They say, quote, "The average African host is exposed to a huge number of infectious diseases from early childhood onwards. These include various bacterial, viral, and parasitic infections. Noteworthy is the wide prevalence of the helminth infections, malaria, and tuberculosis in most parts of Africa, especially in sub-Saharan Africa and the West and West Africa," unquote. They also mark the prevalence of sexually transmitted diseases. Their argument is the reason different patterns and rates of transmission of AIDS are found in Africa in comparison to those found in the West are due to Africans being more susceptible due to their multiple latent or active infections. The dissidents' interpretations is simpler. The average sub-Saharan African being more liable to certain infections than the average Westerners is more likely to be falsely registered as HIV positive because of a flawed test. It's time to turn to how Africans themselves, earlier on, misled by testimonials to the value of blood tests, have begun to see their weaknesses. In a moment, we will see how Neville Hutchinson alerted Africans to articles questioning the test. But if we started with this journey, we will be seriously distorting the picture. We will be in danger of falling into another variation of the ignorant native meets apostle of enlightenment from the West scenario that has already been found so obnoxiously present in the Orthodox literature. Although Neville Hutchinson of the Times of London, and arguably one of the most respected science journalists in the world, did inform many Africans in some areas about unknown dissident views in other areas, African researchers took the lead in finding holes in the test. Hutchinson summarizes an African study in Zaire from mid-1994 in these terms. Scientists, meaning African scientists, have been setting out to investigate if there was a link between HIV positivity and vulnerability to leprosy. They tested a large number of people at a leprosy area and found that something like 70% tested HIV positive. But when they did more detailed examination of the blood of these patients, they found that the real reason that they were positive was not HIV at all. It was that the mycobacterium responsible for leprosy, which is in the same family as the one responsible for TB, was actually causing the proteins to be put into the bloodstream that caused these people to test positive. Meaning, these people didn't have AIDS. They didn't have HIV. They had leprosy and TB, which caused a false positive. When I interviewed Neville Hutchinson, he based his own extensive meetings with African health personnel. Not only were these women and men finding these tests unreliable, but even those who hadn't personally gone into this subject were skeptical. When one questioned them about their personal experience, he said, you found that the doubts were there. He sees a learning curve, the type that I believe occurs generally with the introduction of medical breakthroughs. First, a new drug or process is trumpeted with much fanfare. Temporarily, it is embraced by the public as unlocking a new means of healing or helping as understand the body better. Then, as unanticipated problems arise, people begin to see through the hype and make a more realistic, gauged assessment. It's a cycle that should be familiar from the marketing of a new or improved commodity. I'm not suggesting, by the way, that this indicates gullibility on the part of the public, since when the new item comes on the scene, there's not been time for any independent evaluation, and the only knowledge available about the innovation is purveyed by those whose purpose is to flog it on the older sense, in the older sense of the term. This is more or less the sequence Hodgkinson outlines for the early acceptance of and later disenchantment with the HIV locating blood test. Tests based upon supposed antibodies to HIV were first developed in the mid-1980s. The scientists responsible went over to Africa because they needed to create some kind of a theory about where this bug had come from, and Africa seemed like a good bet to test these kits. And sure enough, they found that there were large numbers of people, 40 to 50% of some populations, were testing positive for the HIV kit. So the idea was put around in the second half of the 80s that HIV had been affecting Africa for some years, and that a huge number, millions, were in the pipeline of death. As time passed, it became clear, in fact, that AIDS statistics, when looked at carefully, were all wrong. It simply wasn't happening. We didn't have a pipeline of death from African AIDS. Hodgkinson traveled to Africa in late 1993, where he was greeted both by those who were wavering about the validity of the test and other orthodox opinions about AIDS relations to Africa, and those who, at personal cost, rejected the orthodox view. Of the first type, he mentioned that once he had shown them an article in Biotechnology which tended to discredit the HIV antibody test, they said, "Well, in fact, although we didn't know about this, we're not surprised to hear this, because we've often noticed that different HIV test kits give widely different results for the number of people testing positive, and we've had our doubts." The second group in Africa had unflinchingly opposed the establishment's view. Some had even gone so far as to argue that in the areas that were supposed to be epicenters of AIDS in Africa, there was no AIDS whatsoever. None. It was a case of mistaken identity arising from the fear induced by this unvalidated and invalid test. The personal cost of espousing such views, even much milder ones, was that with the burgeoning international AIDS scare, more and more money was being earmarked simply for this disease, and any health worker who wasn't working with AIDS victims could expect funding to become a trickle or dry up altogether. As Hodgkinson put it in describing this group of African dissenters, he says, "The people that I had spoken to were respectable workers, and they had everything to lose, in fact, by speaking out like this. There was one couple who started a charity making money for supposed orphans in northern Tanzania on the border with Uganda. They risked their money, and in fact, they lost a lot of funding as a result of speaking out in exactly the way I described, concluding there was no AIDS orphans. In fact, they were the children of poor people that needed help, but that often would describe these children as AIDS orphans when it was known that the charitable money was available only for AIDS. So put it a different way. If your child were starving, you were a poor peasant, and you knew that if you said you were poor, you'd be turned away and given no food, your child would be not taken care of, would you then tell the person your child had AIDS, knowing that, well, yes, we will feed children who are said to be stricken with AIDS, but we won't feed just hungry children? How likely is it that someone will then say, yes, my child has AIDS, knowing that then your child can get what you can't provide them? Daily food, clean water, and an environment that they might be able to grow up and prosper. When life is so tenuous, and you don't know day to day if you're going to have enough to eat, then that is what was happening. We might observe, by the way, that the misspending of health dollars based upon misapprehension of the extent or focus of the disease is not dissimilar here from what we witness in relation to sexual transmission. Where in the United States, homosexual transmission was the norm and heterosexual spread a minute aberration, the refusal to see this on the part of health commissioners meant that the bulk of AIDS education funding would be wasted on warning those who had little chance of getting the disease. In Africa, the analogous case involves targeting money towards an anticipated disease crisis rather than the one already present. Hodgkin said to me, "It's a tragedy, Gary, because it's AIDS funding diverting desperately needed health resources away from the real areas of need, like fighting tuberculosis, like fighting malaria and leprosy." "That's the problem," he said. "Money's not going where it's needed. As a result, people who are sick with those diseases are being diagnosed as AIDS, and they don't have AIDS. Moreover, the institutional system of available hospitals adds to the confusion in that such facilities see itself as treating a designated disease. Thus, as Dr. Kerry Mullis, the Nobel Prize winner, says, in Africa, the only kind of place you can get any medical treatment is at a World Health Organization hospital for AIDS, right? So, anything you come in there for, you cut your knee with a machete. You're an AIDS patient in some little book somewhere. I mean, presumably, you have AIDS too. The underlying problem in all this is not simply that a TB death is reclassified as a TB death led by AIDS-induced immune deficiency collapse, but such mislabeling could happen as well in the United States. What is particularly galling to African dissenters is that just as African AIDS is said to be different, have a different means of transmission than Western AIDS, so it defined according to a wider and laxer criterion than is used in the West. This classification casts a longer shadow over the health of a populace than does the Western categorization. Moreover, the problem goes beyond the fact that the grab bag assortment of diseases linked to AIDS makes diagnosis inaccurate, but that the classifying system itself is of dubious merit insofar as it claims for AIDS a symptomatology that has long been common to unrelated tropical diseases. How do the classifications of Western and African AIDS differ? In the West, AIDS consists of a person having one or more of about 30 relatively rare diseases. You may remember our earlier note that although there is a tendency in the West to keep enlarging the number of opportunistic diseases tied to AIDS, the ones originally tied to immune deficiency such as PCP, which is pneumocystis cranii pneumonia, and many others later added, have been relatively rare conditions, whereas in Africa, AIDS was defined by the World Health Organization in 1986, and Mbangu African AIDS definition is no more than a collage of common symptoms and signs such as cough, fever, and diarrhea, and a few diseases, some of which are virtually endemic in Africa for generations. Specifically, the clinical definition of AIDS in Africa was established at a World Health Organization meeting in the city of Bangui in 1987 and came to be known as the Bangui definition of AIDS. By this criterion, a person can be said to be under attack from AIDS if he or she has a month of a fever, a month of diarrhea, and then dry cough, as well as a weight loss of 10%, vomiting, abdominal pain, a number of opportunistic diseases also given as common symptoms. Well, CD4 cell counts are not part of the definition, as testing is too expensive and therefore entirely unrealistic. And pulmonary tuberculosis, which is TB of the lung, the most common form of the disease, in the presence of HIV is called AIDS. Some doctors and researchers, both African and Western, say the World Health definition of African AIDS is so nebulous and broad that it's virtually meaningless. By broad, I suggest the definition does not center on new conditions of disease found to be existing. Rather, the Bangu, a lineup of symptoms, merely replicates the ones that had already been found in other older diseases. Slim disease, as AIDS is commonly known as in Africa, has become a kind of mop-up term for every disease involving diarrhea, vomiting, and fever, or a cough, which are unfortunately also the primary symptoms of tuberculosis and malaria. Look, if you have tuberculosis, you're going to lose weight. If you have malaria, you're going to lose weight. If you have leprosy, you're going to lose weight. If you're suffering from malnutrition, you're going to lose weight. And you're going to lose weight for a month. And you're going to have a fever. So are you going to be treated for leprosy or malaria? No. You're going to be labeled as a person with AIDS. The same point was made in a front page story in the London Times titled AIDS in Africa, the Plague That Never Was, which argued, quote, the symptoms used to identify AIDS are identical to those associated with common African conditions such as malaria, tuberculosis, parasitic infections, and the effects of malnutrition and unsanitary water, all of which have troubled the continent for decades, unquote. A few pages of reading on this would give you such an enlightenment, but we're not given the information. A Dr. Akuo, out of his quotes in his writings, his thoughts about Africans are not allowed to die from these conditions any longer, meaning you can't die from tuberculosis or malaria any longer. You have to die of AIDS. By this time, the meaning of this epigram should be clear. It seems to him, a doctor who had a long record of service in Ghana, that all the old diseases for which he treated his patients had suddenly become renamed AIDS, although the change of nomenclature is the only thing that separates them from the diseases they were before AIDS was heard of. Perhaps a little background attesting to the thoroughness of his research into the problem would be relevant. In his report in the British medical journal The Lancet, he enumerated, in February and March of this year, I made a six-week tour of 26 cities and towns in 16 sub-Saharan countries, including those most afflicted by AIDS. I did ward rounds with doctors and nurses, met ministers of health, directors or medical services, and research workers. After presenting his findings that rating AIDS in Africa on an arbitrary scale from grade 1, not much of a problem, to grade 5, a catastrophe, only in 5 countries is it to be shown to be even a grade 2. He moves to the topic of throwing so much disease into the AIDS basket. He says, before the days of AIDS in Ghana, there was a death a day on my ward alone of 34 beds. They died from one or another of the following cerebrovascular accidents, from malignant hypertension, hepatoma, ruptured amoebic abscess, chronic renal failure, sickle cell crisis, septicemia, perforated thyroid gut, hepatic coma, hemophilias from tuberculosis, brain tumor, Hodgkin's disease. Today, because of AIDS, it seems that Africans are not allowed to die from these conditions any longer. They must die from AIDS. I'm Gary Nall. If you just joined us, we're talking about AIDS. Special report. And for those of you who have been following this series, and it is a series of in-depth investigations, and it's taken a long time for me to do all the research, thousands and thousands of hours, to put all this information together so it will make sense. This is number 16 in my report. Number 16. And if you want a copy of the show, you'll dial 888-317-2346. 888-317-2346. Program 16. Before, I gave you number 13, 12, 11, and 10. Those were inaccurate. Those should be 16, 15, 14, and 13. Now, let's continue. You must have already gathered that the pandemic nature of malaria, tuberculosis, and other illnesses in Africa, due to a lack of medical care and poor living conditions, results in general poor health conditions than in the West, which, among other things, will register in the general public having weak immune systems that will be in more danger of infectious invasions. When I mentioned Joan Shenton on a previous program, she put it to me like this. She said, and she's, by the way, an award-winning reporter and telebroadcaster, and she's done an outstanding book and documentary on AIDS, virtually unknown here in the United States, unfortunately. She says, people in Africa are dying of pathogenic assault, which is caused by filthy water, bacteria, tuberculosis, and parasites. Commonly, she says, one will find children having malaria 8 times before they're 8. Children having enormous bouts of terrible diarrhea 11 times in their first year. It is not surprising, then, that there is a high death rate, especially for children. These are the conditions that are leading to death, she told me, then noted further, so people are called AIDS patients if they're showing these symptoms. Now, in a moment, we'll delve a little further into the uncanny coincidence of unhealthy living conditions and the incidence of AIDS in Africa. But a couple final points should be made on the scientific aspects of the AIDS scare. These have to do with what would need to be done by scientists if, rather than relying on an all-encompassing definitions, fallible blood tests, and skewed statistical projections, they wanted to objectively assess whether there was evidence of an AIDS epidemic in Africa. This would mean taking account of existing disease patterns and studying the history of health and health expectations on the continent. The first point seems shockingly obvious, although it's been systematically overlooked in discussions on the subject. It's an unfortunate fact that in southern Middle Africa, governments or health organizations have never had the resources to collect statistics on disease or death. Without health registers, there's no way, then, to know how bad, in relative terms, the disease outbreak is. The hypothesis of a new virus needs to be checked against the pre-existing death pattern, but there are no such data. In Africa, births and deaths have only been registered in the memory of people. It is a very poor source from which to try to calculate the specific death per age group and per disease 100 years ago. It's true, let's imagine, that in a small southern African country, there are now 1,000 deaths per annum from tuberculosis. Compilations rising, it said, from AIDS. This number might seem startling, but it holds less meaning than it might appear as long as we do not possess information on previous rates of death. It may be that 5 years ago, before AIDS existed, or 20 years ago, in that country, 999 people died annually of tuberculosis. Moreover, the West's sudden interest in Africa cannot make up for the years of neglect expressed in the West's lagging memory of previous incidents of disease there, coupled with unappreciation of socio-cultural factors. Let us not forget that in Africa, the sudden onset of a new and for a time unidentified disease is not unprecedented. If it was the first epidemic of this type in the region, it could be of some meaning. But it is not the first time that many young adults have died here. In the 1940s, sudden and mysterious diseases, later qualified as syphilis, caused such havoc that the elderly went to the border of Burundi to look for women to repopulate their villages, which are said to now be devastated by AIDS. And let's call attention to the evolution of rising expectations in sub-Saharan Africa, which in the latter 20th century has brought Africans to, if not achieve, at least be aware that better health is possible. This perception is what is behind the average African sense of crisis. There's a rampant, very subjective feeling that something has gone wrong with the health of the adults. Several decades ago, at the time when life expectancy was low, such a feeling may not have taken off. However, with upped aspirations, there is a palpable unease. But since colonization, people have seen hospitals, medicines, immunizations gradually shortening the usual course of their pathologies. And the present generation has forgotten the very toll, heavy toll, that life had to pay when natural immunity was the only potion for longevity. Aside from the content of what I just spoke, it can be taken as exemplary in once again calling our attention to the need to wrestle with the bigger picture in Africa, including the continent's history, to reach an adequate understanding of what's going on. We might say it is a hallmark of bad science associated with orthodox study of AIDS to unduly isolate one factor as being all-encompassing without taking the trouble to situate that factor in the wider universe of impending facts. Notwithstanding that the experimental method itself involves radical separation of elements of study, this type of careful disaffirmation and separating out is only proper in certain fields of science aiming at certain results. Outside its natural time and space, such isolation becomes fetishized, that is, put forward to the detriment of truth-seeking. We saw it in the establishment's insistence that there was a single cause that can be held to be the guilty party behind the AIDS illness, and now we are seeing it in the belief that it is this outlandish disease which is causing the health devastation in Africa. As I hope to show in the next set of circumstances I'll be sharing with you on this program, it is not a microscopic or a retrovirus, but a macro cause, the collapse of the infrastructure, which is producing in Africa conditions that resemble but are not the same as a plague. In both cases, though, it often seems what was wanted was not the true culprit, but a patsy. In the former case, as we saw, some have argued that the rush to label HIV the sole cause of so many different illnesses was to achieve a sense of closure and dampen public fears, regardless of the scantiness of the evidence. What I mean by the second contention will be shown in the next discussion I'm going to have here, in which I lay out some ideas about the culpability of the African political economy for a generalized health breakdown, and give some suggestions why the West is reluctant to admit to these conditions and so would prefer to charge them to the HIV scapegoat. Let's look at socio-cultural conditions and the poor health of sub-Saharan Africa. And again, if you've just joined us, I'm Gary Nall, and this is a part of an ongoing series I am doing on AIDS and offering a second opinion. Manuel Castell is an ambitious three-volume text, that he has authored, has produced one of the most responsible works of futurology that appeared at the end of the 20th century. By calling it responsible, I mean that though he occasionally shares the breathlessness that these works are known for, he counters these passages with sober assessments of the downside of present trends. In the first volume, The Rise of the Network Society, one of the most negative of all the developments he charts for the coming millennium is the absence of sub-Saharan Africa from the emerging world economy. The results will be Africa's continuing turmoil, which he believes will be ignored by the West, in that, unlike developments in the Middle East or Eastern Europe, for example, the region's chaos does not impinge on the priorities of the industrialized world. Castell's characterizations of the history and unhappy conditions in the area, some of the most concise and precise I have seen, have to be quoted in depth to give us background on why general health there seems to in steep decline. First, for capsule history. When the oil shock of 1979 and the rise of interest rates provoked their financial bankruptcy, most African economies came under the direct control policies of international financial institutions that imposed liberalization measures supposedly aimed at generating trade and investment. The fragile African economies did not resist the shock. The competitive positions of African countries in international trade was not brilliant in the 1960s, but deteriorated dramatically after the reinvention of international financial institutions. While liberalization policies were not able to attract investment or improve competitiveness, what they did was to destroy large sectors of agricultural production for local markets and, in some cases, subsistence agriculture. As a result, African countries were left without defense against the impact of bad harvests. When drought struck in Central and Eastern Africa, widespread famine followed, aggravated by civil wars and banditry, induced by the heritage of surrogate military confrontation between the superpowers, because states, as intermediaries between their countries and meager resources transferred from abroad, were the main source of income, control of the state became a matter of survival. And because tribal and ethnic networks were the safest bet for people support, the fight to control the state was organized around ethnic cleavage, a reviving century-old hatred and prejudice. Now, bringing the situation up to present, Castells notes that Africa has been cast to the sidelines, the newly integrated circuits of the world economy. It's left out. Overall, the systematic logic of the new global economy does not have much of a role for the majority of the African population in the newest international divisions of labor. Most primary commodities are useless or low-priced. Markets are too narrow. Investments too risky. Labor not skilled enough. Communications and telecommunication infrastructure clearly inadequate. Politics too unpredictable. And government bureaucracy inefficient and utterly corrupt. Now, under such conditions, the only real concern of the North, particularly of Western Europe, was the fear of being invaded by millions of uprooted peasants and workers unable to survive in their own countries. Yet, what can be said of the experience of the transition of Africa into the new global economy is that the land's position has become one of structured irrelevance from the system's point of view. The way it worked was like this. Taking Senegal as an example, in the late 1970s, many villages went into debt. Landlords in the state, guided by pressure from Western experts, demanded the land be put into cash crop, notably peanuts. Even peasant groups who did not have outstanding IOUs were tempted to conversion because of higher prices being paid for the food. Then, when the price collapsed on the international market, the peasants had neither money nor food. The choice was usually to go to the city to swell the unemployed, starve on the land, or join the military for plunder. It is the devastation brought by these blood-curdling social conditions that many researchers target as playing a causal role in the plummeting health conditions in the region, which the Orthodox blame on AIDS. Dr. Charles Geschechter at California State University, Chico, says bluntly, it is the political economy of underdevelopment, not sexual intercourse, that is killing Africans. He elaborates by stressing such factors as poor harvests, rural poverty, migratory labor systems, urban crowding, ecological degradation, and the sadistic violence of civil wars, which have disrupted such minimal health care facilities and sanitation as had existed. And when essential services for water, power, and transport break down, public sanitation deteriorates and the risks of cholera and dysentery increase. Again, he says, African poverty, not some extraordinary sexual behavior, is the best predictor of AIDS-defining diseases. Like the fact about lack of comparable mortality statistics making it hard to gauge how bad the disease is, the thought that denigrating living situations would be playing a large part in a new disease formations on the continent would seem a rather obvious conclusion to draw, but it is not one put forward by the establishment. Some have seen this on their side as resulting from the same mindset that has often marred Westerners' opinions on Africa. Conclusions are being drawn without consulting people on the ground. According to Dr. Peter Duisberg, most of the people who talk about AIDS in Africa are living here in Atlanta at the CDC or somewhere, or the World Health Organization in Geneva. They're not bothering to go to Africa. As our guide Bacon puts this point, Francis Bacon, more generally, in nature, the more you remove yourself from particulars, the greater peril of error you do incur. This contention is echoed by other dissidents, whose opinion, reported in a London Sunday Times article, is that those who have worked with Africans know that what is considered AIDS over there is nothing more than a new term for old diseases. And Dr. Philippi and Dr. Cryon, who led a medical relief organization in Tanzania, met people and said to have the immune deficiency disease. Well, according to the story, they told me, contrary to their expectations, they learned that there is no AIDS. Let me repeat that. These are highly credible people. These are people you have not heard of before. These are people whose opinion the mainstream media has not sought out. But these are people, nonetheless, who were there. Let me say again, they told me, Gary, there is no AIDS. It is something that has been invented. There are no epidemiological grounds for it. It doesn't exist for us. Now, those are people who are there in Africa. Sylvia Farber, whose trip to Africa I already mentioned, also has written on how going to the African countries deeply influenced her point of view. She says, we saw many sick, dying, and even dead people during this trip. But the task of trying to decipher just what they were truly dying of struck me as impossible. Often their doctors didn't even know. Now, these last set of quotes, contrasting Duisberg's opinion on why Western doctors may be exaggerating or overlooking aspects of African reality not visible from afar with opinions of those who had extensively worked or visited Africa, highlights the division between those who know and those who dream they know. But, as we've said, there's also a basic difference over how researchers assess the causative factors behind that disease. Why should those establishment doctors, chilling in Geneva and Atlanta, waste time on field trips if they remain convinced the disease is caused by a virus, which can be as easily studied with flown-in African blood in one's air-conditioned office as at the site? From this perspective, the poor social conditions in Africa could be discounted in diagnosing what seemed to be increases in TB or other diseases that were being associated with AIDS. For dissenters like Creenan, though, such a point of view is the problem. Creenan says the Western look at health, after peering into so many microscopes, has become myopic. It does not see that in Africa, it is no such tiny microbe which has to be tracked down as the conditions favoring disease proliferation. AIDS is a perception. The more you look for it, the more you see it. That's according to Dr. Cassie Manlin, Cote d'Ivoire Director General of Health and Social Services. He might have added, the more you want to see it, the more you will find it. In other words, macabre as it may seem, there are those groups all over the place that are motivated to make us as much of the crisis as possible. This would include, most obviously, those whose livelihoods depend upon treating the disease, but would also serve such interests as the media, who increase readers or viewers by touting catastrophic figures, those who want to shift responsibility for spreading the disease away from particularly high-risk groups, and those who cynically hope to test AIDS drugs on African guinea pigs. For all these groups, the projection of astronomical figures for African AIDS can be wielded as a weapon for convenience. Let's look at some of the groups who are strangely allied in their willingness to give easy credence to the thought that all Africa is or will be devastated by this new immune deficiency. Earlier on in the program, I called a number of African doctors dissidents. I do not mean to imply that these health workers and doctors are fiery foes of orthodoxy who rail against the West's stereotyping, nor that they represent a majority. In fact, many, perhaps the majority of African healthcare workers are establishment-oriented and accept orthodoxy's views of causation, transmission, and with less fervency, African origin or African approaching devastation. However, these conservatives can be separated from their Western counterparts insofar as they have different reasons for agreeing with the dogma. Just as their Western brethren, they may well be sincere advocates of these opinions, but their comparative financial advantages to them for holding this view will be much greater. This is not to say that an African doctor, for instance, can pull down a bigger salary than a CDC retrovirologist, but that given the region's unreservedly bleak economic situation, AIDS funding from abroad can be quite lucrative compared to other sources of income. Many believe that the statistics of the number of AIDS sufferers in Africa have been inflated because AIDS generates far more money in the third world from Western organizations than any other infectious disease. When we investigate this in depth, we see some truth in what many believe, at least insofar as AIDS producing funding. This was clear to us when we were researching this in Africa. Where there was AIDS, there was always money. A brand new clinic, a new Mercedes parked outside, modern testing facilities, high-paying jobs, international conferences. Well, that's for AIDS. And when you talk with an African doctor in London, as Suya Farber did, who told her that she would have trouble learning the facts because it pays for many health workers to conceal them. She said, or the doctor said, you will never get these doctors to tell you the truth. When they get sent to the AIDS conferences around the world, the per diem they receive is equal to what they would earn in an entire year at home. Suya Farber learned that to obtain information from establishment officials, it was wise to, in turn, conceal something of her own intentions. In Uganda, obstacles were overcome when she said she wanted to tell her young American readers what a terrible toll AIDS was taking. She found that African officials had sound economic reasons for wanting such a message spread, as she wrote. While the public seemed resentful of the constant repetition that AIDS is wiping out Africa, the officials generally nod in somber agreement when the most dire statistics are cited. And to what end? AIDS generates far more money than any other disease in Africa. In Uganda, for example, the World Health Organization allocates $6 million a single year, whereas all other infectious diseases combined, TB, all of them combined, receive merely $57,000. One of those diseases, malaria, is the leading killer of people worldwide, and several drug-resistant strains of malaria have been emerging in recent years. So, similar reflections on the way AIDS funding can appear as a gravy train to healthcare workers have been made, and as cuttingly, Dr. Eliopoulos has stated, and her emphasis, however, is on the tragic waste of resources entailed when more threatening diseases, again, the case cited is malaria, had their financial allotments cut so as to swell the AIDS dedicated bucket. In one country in Africa, there was a gleaming Toyota van, whole fleet of them, with young sex counselors in them, with bags of condoms in the back, racing around the countryside, telling people not to make love to anyone new. Meanwhile, malaria control, which used to have a lot of money, was nowhere to be found in any van. Malaria was epidemic in those communities. AIDS was not. But now all these people stricken with malaria had condoms. Isn't it interesting? Give them condoms. Give them lectures. Take the money. And everyone looked the other way. I'm Gary Nall. And this brings us up to the end of this particular program on time always limited in discussing AIDS, A Second Opinion.